Chapter 34. Be long and active, and for the sake of him, I care for what I shall never see, and wish to make pleasant what I shall never enjoy. I am setting his room in order, as the place will be his own freehold when I am gone, so that when he comes back he may find all his poor gimcracks and tranglies as he left them, and not feel that I have betrayed his trust. Mrs. Martin's voice revealed that as he had burst into such few tears as were left her, and then Anna began crying likewise, whereupon Lady Constantine, whose heart had been bursting all day and who, indeed, considering her coming trouble, had reason enough for tears, broke into bitterer sobs than either sobs of absolute pain that could no longer be concealed. Anna was the first to discover that Lady Constantine was weeping with them, and her feelings being probably the least intense among the three, she instantly controlled herself. "Refrain yourself, my dear woman, refrain!" She said hastily to Mrs. Martin. "Don't ye see how it do wrath my lady?" And turning to Viviette she whispered, "Her years be so great, your ladyship, that perhaps ye'll excuse her for busting out afore ye. We know when the mind is dim, my lady, there's not the manners there should be, but decayed people can't help it, poor old soul." "Anna, that will do now. Perhaps Lady Constantine would like to speak to me alone," said Mrs. Martin. And when Anna had retreated, Mrs. Martin continued, "Such a charge as she is, my lady, on account of her great age. You'll pardon her biding here, as if she were one of the family. I put up with such things, because of her long service, and we know that years lead to childishness." "What are you doing? Can I help you?" Viviette asked, as Mrs. Martin, after speaking, turned to lift some large article. "Oh, 'tis only the skeleton of a telescope that's got no works in his inside," said Swithin's grandmother, seizing the huge pasteboard tube that Swithin had made, and abandoned because he could get no lenses to suit it. "I am going to hang it up to these hooks, and there it will bide till he comes again." Lady Constantine took one end, and the tube was hung up against the whitewashed wall by strings that the old woman had tied round it. "Here's all his equinoctial lines, and his topics of Capricorn, and I don't know what besides," Mrs. Martin continued, pointing to some charcoal scratches on the wall. "I shall never rub 'em out. No, though 'tis such untidiness as I was never brought up to, I shall never rub 'em out." "Where has Swithin gone to first?" asked Viviette anxiously. "Where does he say you are to write to him?"
"Nowhere yet, my lady. He's gone traipsing all over Europe and America, and then to the South Pacific Ocean about this transit of Venus that's going to be done there. He is to write to us first God knows when. For he said that, if we didn't hear from him for 6 months we were not to be gullied at all."
At this intelligence, so much worse than as he had expected, Lady Constantine stood mute, sank down, and would have fallen to the floor if there had not been a chair behind her. Controlling herself by a strenuous effort, she disguised her despair and asked vacantly, "From America to the South Pacific transit of Venus?"
Swithin's arrangement to accompany the expedition had been made at the last moment, and therefore as he had not as yet been informed.
"Yes, to a lone island, I believe."
"Yes, a lone island, my lady."
Echoed Anna, who had crept in and made herself one of the family again, in spite of Mrs. Martin. "He is going to meet the English and American astronomers there at the end of the year. After that he will most likely go on to the Cape."
"But before the end of the year, what places did he tell you of visiting?"
"Let me collect myself. He is going to the Observatory of Cambridge, United States,
to meet some gentlemen there, and spy through the great refractor. Then there's the Observatory of Chicago, and I think he has a letter to make him beckon to a gentleman in the observatory at Marseille, and he wants to go to Vienna and Pulkowa too. He means to take in his way there being great instruments, and a lot of astronomers at each place. Does he take Europe or America first? She asked faintly, for the account seemed hopeless. Mrs. Martin could not tell till as he had heard from Swithin. It depended upon what he had decided to do on the day of his leaving England. Lady Constantine bade the old people goodbye, and dragged her weary limbs homeward. The fatuousness of forethought had seldom been evinced more ironically. Had she done nothing to hinder him, he would have kept up an unreserved communication with her, and all might have been well. For that night she could undertake nothing further, and she waited for the next day. Then at once she wrote two letters to Swithin, directing one to Marseille Observatory, one to the Observatory of Cambridge, U.S.S., as being the only two spots on the face of the globe at which they were likely to intercept him. Each letter stated to him the urgent reasons which existed for his return, and contained a passionately regretful intimation that the annuity on which his hopes depended must of necessity be sacrificed by the completion of their original contract without delay. But letter conveyance was too slow a process to satisfy her. To send an epitome of her epistles by telegraph was, after all, indispensable. Such an imploring sentence as she desired to address to him, it would be hazardous to dispatch from Warburn, and she took a dreary journey to a strange town on purpose, to send it from an office at which she was unknown. There she handed in her message, addressing it to the port of arrival of the Occidental, and again returned home. She waited, and there being no return telegram, the inference was that he had somehow missed hers. For an answer to either of her letters she would have to wait long enough to allow him time to reach one of the observatories a tedious while. Then she considered the weakness, the stultifying nature of her attempt at recall. Events mocked her on all sides. By the favor of an accident, and by her own immense exertions against her instincts, Swithin had been restored to the rightful heritage that he had nearly forfeited on her account. He had just started off to utilize it, when she, without a moment's warning, was asking him again to cast it away. As he had set a certain machinery in motion, to stop it before it had revolved once. A horrid apprehension possessed her. It had been easy for Swithin to give up what he had never known the advantages of keeping, but having once begun to enjoy his possession, would he give it up now? Could he be depended on for such self-sacrifice? Before leaving, he would have done anything at her request, but the malia tempora fandi had now passed. Suppose there arrived no reply from him for the next 3 months, and that when his answer came he were to inform her that, having now fully acquiesced in her original decision, he found the life he was leading so profitable as to be unable to abandon it, even to please her. That he was very sorry, but having embarked on this course by her advice he meant to adhere to it by his own. There was, indeed, every probability that, moving about as he was doing, and cautioned as he had been by her very self against listening to her too readily, she would receive no reply of any sort from him for 3 or perhaps 4 months. This would be on the eve of the transit. And what likelihood was there that a young man, full of ardor for that spectacle, would forego it at the last moment, to return to a humdrum domesticity with a woman who was no longer a novelty? If she could only leave him to his career, and save her own situation also. But at that moment the proposition seemed as impossible as to construct a triangle of two straight lines. In her walk home, pervaded by these hopeless views, she passed near the dark and deserted tower. Night in that solitary place, which would have caused her some uneasiness in her years of blindness, had no terrors for her now. She went up the winding path, and, the door being unlocked, felt her way to the top. The open sky greeted her as in times previous to the dome and equatorial period, but there was not a star to suggest to her in which direction Swithin had gone. The absence of the dome suggested a way out of her difficulties. A leap in the dark, and all would be over. But she had not reached that stage of action as yet, and the thought was dismissed as quickly as it had come. The new consideration which at present occupied her mind was whether she could have the courage to leave Swithin to himself, as in the original plan, and singly meet her impending trial, despising the shame, till he should return at 5:20 and claim her? Yet was this assumption of his return so very safe? How altered things would be at that time! At 25 he would still be young and handsome. She would be 33, fading to middle age and homeliness, from a junior's point of view. A fear sharp as a frost settled down upon her, that in any such scheme as this, she would be building upon the sand. She hardly knew how she reached home that night. Entering by the lawn door, she saw a red coal in the direction of the arbor. Louis was smoking there, and he came forward. He had not seen her since the morning, and was naturally anxious about her. She blessed the chance which enveloped her in night, and lessened the weight of the encounter one half, by depriving him of vision. "Did you accomplish your object?" he asked. "No," said she. "How was that?" he assailed. "A very good thing for both, I say. I believe you would have married him, if you could have overtaken him." "That would I." She said. "Good God." "I would marry a tinker for that matter. I have reasons for being any man's wife." She said recklessly, "only I should prefer to drown myself." Louis held his breath, and stood rigid at the meaning her words conveyed. "But Louis, you don't know all." Cried Viviette. "I am not so bad as you think. Mine has been folly, not vice. I thought I had married him, and then I found I had not. The marriage was invalid. Sir Blount was alive. And now Swithin has gone away, and will not come back for my calling. How can he? His fortune is left him on condition that he forms no legal tie. Oh, will he come again?" "Never, if that's the position of affairs," said Louis firmly, after a pause. "What then shall I do?" said Viviette. Louis escaped the formidable difficulty of replying by pretending to continue his Havana, and she, bowed down to dust by what he had revealed, crept from him into the house. Louis' cigar went out in his hand as he stood looking intently at the ground. XXXIX, Louis got up the next morning with an idea in his head. He had dressed for a journey, and breakfasted hastily. Before he had started, Viviette came downstairs. Louis, who was now greatly disturbed about her, went up to his sister, and took her hand. "Aux grands mox les grands remits," he said, gravely. "I have a plan." "I have a dozen." Said she. "You have?" "Yes. But what are they worth? And yet there must be a way." "Viviette," said Louis, "promise that you will wait till I come home tonight, before you do anything." Her distracted eyes showed slight comprehension of his request as she said yes. An hour after that time, Louis entered the train at Warburn, and was speedily crossing a country of ragged woodland, which, though intruded on by the plow at places, remained largely intact from prehistoric times, and still abounded with yews of gigantic growth and oaks tufted with mistletoe. It was the route to Melchester. On setting foot in that city, he took the cathedral spire as his guide, the place being strange to him, and went on till he reached the archway dividing Melchester sacred from Melchester secular. Thence he threaded his course into the precincts of the damp and venerable close, level as a bowling green, and beloved of rooks, who from their elm perches on high, threatened any unwary gazer with the mishap of Tobit. At the corner of this reposeful spot stood the Episcopal Palace. Louis entered the gates, rang the bell, and looked around. Here the trees and rooks seemed older, if possible, than those in the close behind him. Everything was dignified, and he felt himself like Punchinello in the king's chambers. Verily in the present case Glanville was not a man to stick at trifles any more than his illustrious prototype. And on the servant bringing a message that his lordship would see him at once, Louis marched boldly in. Through an old dark corridor, roofed with old dark beams, the servant led the way to the heavily molded door of the bishop's room. Dr. Helmsdale was there, and welcomed Louis with considerable stateliness. But his condescension was tempered with a curious anxiety, and even with nervousness. He asked in pointed tones after the health of Lady Constantine, if Louis had brought an answer to the letter he had addressed to her a day or two earlier, and if the contents of the letter, or of the previous one, were known to him. I have brought no answer from her, apostrophe said Louis, but the contents of your letter have been made known to me. ... Since entering the building Louis had more than once felt some hesitation, and it might now, with a favoring manner from his entertainer, have operated to deter him from going further with his Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.